Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Such a pleasure to be able to share positive insights that can empower us. And by the way, I want to thank the people in India for listening in and the group of doctors who listen in every day from Ireland. We're heard all over the world. We're the number one progressive radio program in the world. And we're right up there. And that's possibly because I select information that no matter what your background, your age, your health status, you can benefit from it. Things that are easy to find, non-toxic and natural, and have proven scientific basis for helping you. For example, when we start today, I'll give you the item that is important. For example, this is Harvard School of Public Health. One spoonful of olive oil daily can save the brain from dementia. That's correct. A new study suggests that incorporating olive oil into your diet can help reduce the risk of dying from dementia. Well, every morning when I have my health drink, I always put 1 to 2 tablespoons of extra virgin organic cold-pressed olive oil into it. And by the way, there is so much counterfeit food being produced in the world, it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars a year, that I check with the manufacturer. Can you show me by independent chemical assay that this is 100% olive oil, it's organic, and it's not a cut oil where they use soy or some other oil to replace the olive oil? If they can do that, then I'll go ahead and use it. In any case, as many countries facing rising rates of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia, this study offers hope that healthy lifestyle factors such as a good, clean diet can help to prevent or slow the progression of those devastating conditions. So, how easy is that? 1 tablespoon of extra virgin olive oil. But I suggest you have 1 in the morning and 1 in the evening. And by the way, there are a lot of people who die of dementia, and this lowers your risk of dying from dementia compared to those who don't consume olive oil by 28%. Now, mind you, that's not taking into account glycerol phosphocholine or phosphatidylserine or NAD or PQQ and all the other nutrients we know that also resveratrol slow down the aging of the brain and turn off inflammation in the body. All right? Just something that easy, that inexpensive, and that good. Don't buy the cheap brands because that's where you're going to find the most adulterated. Now, from Warren Albert Medical School of Brown University, higher vitamin D levels associated with less severe psoriasis. And this was published in Nutrition and the peer-reviewed journal. So let's just get our vitamin D up. Now, the weather now allows you to get out and get some sunshine. Do so. If you don't, make sure you're taking about 3,000 milligrams a day of the omega-3 fatty acids and also 3 to 5,000 milligrams a day of vitamin D3. Those two go together very nicely. And if you want to help protect your immune system, take 15 to 20 milligrams of zinc per day. That also helps. It's that simple. Again, nothing complicated. Now, what gets complicated is when you go through menopause. I used a protocol that I came up with, working with individuals over decades, and I had a menopausal study. It lasted a year. We met every week, 500 women. Now, these women were in menopause or postmenopausal. Now, any woman going through menopause, depending upon your state of health and your diet, will have no symptoms or lots of symptoms, such as thinning of the eyebrow, loss of hair, more rapid aging of the skin, loss of muscle mass, loss of strength, fatigue, insomnia, digestive problems, emotional swings because your hormones like dopamine and serotonin are out of adjustment. In any case, and also weight gain without extra eating. And it's really challenging if you don't know what you're doing. So for women in menopause, and by the way, 8 women who were postmenopause, the oldest by 8 years, became premenopausal again. And women were reporting now they had their full hair back and their eyebrows, and their fingernails and toenails were smooth and pink and hard, shiny. They got their muscle mass back. They had energy. They were sleeping through the night. They no longer had the mood swings, and weight came off. So protocols work. And I'll be sharing that protocol with you on an upcoming Classroom on the Air. By the way, don't forget, every day I do a Classroom on the Air. I film it like I'm doing this. You can go to prn.live, scroll down to archive, scroll on down to Gary Nall, and you'll see what I'm broadcasting. See me live, or you can see clips from films that I'm showing. But in any case, I do a Classroom on the Air, and it's a full spectrum of topics. And I'm going to start a whole series on different approaches, natural approaches to overcoming illnesses, breast cancer, prostate cancer, dementia, Alzheimer's, diabetes. So that's right coming up right now. And you can go to Gary Nall YouTube and download. None of these are controversial. These are not my hard-hitting investigative reports. They wouldn't be allowed on there. They're not my hard-hitting documentaries. Just good, practical, positive, uplifting information. All right? Now, older women at risk of Alzheimer's disease may benefit from yoga, who says? UCLA, Simmel Institute of Neuroscience. Kundalini yoga, a form of yoga that focuses on breathing, slow diaphragmatic breathing, meditation, and mental visualization, are beneficial for older women who had risk factors for Alzheimer's disease and concerns about episodes of memory decline. That's according to the study. So how about that, Kundalini yoga? And by the way, Kundalini and Tantric yoga both have something in common. They're based upon being able to guide energy, your chi, your vital life force, throughout your body. And that's important because you can get the chi into the heart, you can get it into the brain. It allows you to calm down, calm your breathing down. And sometimes just anxiety by itself can cause cortisol levels to go up, your stress hormone. Important if you need it, but deadly if you don't, especially if you're chronically stressed or live with some kind of existential angst. Can't put your finger on it, but just don't feel right. In any case, what we've now seen is the electrical charges to your heart by being stressed can take it out of balance, and you can go into AFib or tachycardia, irregular heartbeat, and that increases your risk of stroke and heart attack. So acupuncture is one way of helping it, acupressure, but also the Kundalini breathing, tantric breathing, calming your energy, calm that energy. All right? What you see now, how I speak, is how I am. I don't see any reason to get all upset and bent out of shape and yell and scream over things that I may have control over or may not. But what's important, I can control my breathing. I can't control what you think of me. If you write a toxic letter, that's your right. All right? But it's my right to say, that's not me you're talking about. That's something you don't like about yourself that you're projecting upon me. So remember, you don't have control over your emotions when everyone else is allowed in to manipulate and play with those emotions. And deep breathing, yoga, meditation, put it all together, and you have more control over not the circumstances in your life, but how you respond to them. Just something simple and easy. And as you see, virtually everything I'm telling you is coming from the National Library of Medicine in PubMed. Now, one thing I want you to be concerned about, and this is from the University of Chicago, losing your sense of smell can be an early warning sign for people carrying Alzheimer's genes. A new study finds that people with a specific gene could experience a particular early warning sign that they're developing dementia, losing their sense of smell. Now, yes, with certain viruses like COVID, you can also lose your sense of smell. But this is when you don't have COVID, you don't have an infection, otherwise you're okay. But then you're not aware that APOE4 genes were 37% less likely to have a good sense of smell. And those who carry this gene, known to increase the risk of Alzheimer's, experience a decline in their ability to detect, sense, between the ages of 65 and 69. You know, just something to help those who generally don't have any help. And also, consuming a soluble diet rich in fiber is a good way of renewing your intestinal epithelial cells. This is from the State University Campinas Institute of Biology in Brazil. Simply stated, in that fiber, you're going to have what is called inulin, I-N-U-L-I-N. It's a soluble fiber abundant in chicory root, for example, and can influence even the length and other macroscopic characteristics of the intestines. So if you want healthier intestines, don't we all, and healthier digestion, utilization, absorption, and elimination, and that's where your high fiber diet comes in. The berries in particular are really good. And the sauerkraut's good, tempeh is good, a beet juice is good, apple cider vinegar is good. All of these things help with the gut microbiota, microbiota. And that means the good bacteria in your gut. The healthier gut, the healthier immune system. This was published in the peer journal Microbiome. And one last one before we go on to the other program is antidepressant drugs do not, I repeat, do not improve well-being in children and adolescents. Now that's a big statement. And for those of you who came to the world premiere of my new film, Manufacturing Madness, or came to the webinar on it, then you already know this. But for everyone else, the most respected independent scientific group in the world, called the Cochrane Collaboration, just published an article in Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics and said that the antidepressant drugs on the well-being in children and adolescents were analyzed. And it was a meta-analysis, meaning they looked at every kind of study and the efficacy of second-generation antidepressants for young people. They concluded that such drugs possess a, quote, statistically significant advantage over placebo in terms of clinical, clinician-related depression symptoms. However, no meta-analysis has included measures of quality of life, global mental health, self-esteem, and autonomy. So, you know, think twice. There are other non-toxic ways of dealing with life's issues, and ADHD and ADD, all right, and agitation, and hyperactivity, and loneliness, and other things that happen to all of us in life. But there are natural ways of dealing with it. That's it on health and nutrition. And remember, I also have the Gary Noll newsletter, published by John LaBelle. And to get that newsletter, go to GaryNoll.com, scroll down, you'll see a newsletter. Because I'm in an interesting place. I've been working my whole life, but right now I'm looking at how focusing on certain projects, self-empowerment projects, a gigantic encyclopedia for every therapy imaginable, a natural approach that everyone should have access to, a new documentary on addictive behavior, all addictions. I'm doing a lot, and articles, commentaries, and I put a lot of this information into the newsletter on a regular basis, plus recipes, because I'm also a gourmet vegan chef. So take advantage of it. In any case, we're going to take a break, come right back. We have a lot of interesting stuff to share. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Noll. What you're about to see now from Michael Schellenberger, who historically has been an outstanding liberal Democrat journalist, used to appear all the time on all the major newscasts and share insights because of his journalistic techniques and what he discovered. He's right there with Matt Taibbi and Chris Hedges. And then he began to look deeper on one of the issues, climate change. And the more he dug, he found that there were contradictions between what the media was saying, what the government was saying, and what the independent science was showing. And he began to write about it. And that opened up a whole new door to him. And now he does not support many of the views of the main establishment on climate change. Now, I do not agree with everything he says. I have taken issue with many of the things, but he also has a lot of truth. And he was vilified, canceled, and attacked for daring to challenge one of the sacred tenets of the liberal community, and that is that we have to deal with climate change right now, and that is to get rid of all fossil fuels, go to zero polluting carbon dioxide, and to do it quickly because, as Cortez and other people have said, we have maybe at that time 12 years, now it's 9 years before there's catastrophic events. Now he has left go of the left. He's left the left. He's giving a talk about this at a university. And whether you agree or disagree with anything he says, listen to what his arguments are, how he backs up his arguments, the evidence he has for his arguments. And if I have him on my program, it'll be as a debate, as I did this week with an outstanding academic who I felt was off base and had completely different points of view. So I wanted to share that with our audience. So we had that debate. Well, I'd like to do the same with him, but I find that he is more accurate than inaccurate. And I believe he comes from a place of integrity, not based upon politics. But now he sees how much politics, ideology, played in his thinking and his development. By the way, he's not alone. A lot of people are leaving the left, as a lot of people have left the right, and for good reason. Because when you have just one truth, then you can't challenge it. But what if the truth is elsewhere? Too bad. Believe it. And look at how many times the people telling us this is the truth were wrong. COVID, they were wrong about everything. Everything. There was no pandemic. There was a pandemic of the false positives from the test they used, the PCR test. How do I know? Well, because I was a professional friend of the man who won the Nobel Prize, Kary Mullis, and go up on the internet. It went viral. Millions of people watched this. He said, don't use my test for making these diagnoses. It has to be at low amplifications. Otherwise, you're just looking at cellular junk. Well, what was his amplification? Somewhere between 13, ideally, and 16 repetitions. What did Anthony Fauci say showed it was junk? I think he said over around 31 or 2 or something in there. What was the amount of replications in your and every American and all over the world's PCR test? 41 to 44. Total junk. Total junk. It's not in dispute. But we didn't think before we did this. And so everyone tested positive. And they were a case, meaning they had the disease, and then that justified, oh, we have a pandemic, all these people are infected. It wasn't true. And that kind of virus works itself through the population for younger, healthier people with no comorbidities, just like the flu. Maybe a little severe, but a lot of people didn't even have symptoms. We had treatments at work, so everything we did was wrong. How many journalists had the integrity to call those mistakes out? Only a handful. How many journalists went along with it and are still going along with the myths? The masks work, they didn't. And I did a whole expose on that, wrote an article on it, showing you the actual scientific literature. So we did everything wrong. Well, it doesn't matter whether you come from the right or left, Democrat or Republican, if you're making your choices based upon what the so-called experts are telling you, you're going to be wrong. Because we've been wrong on all these issues. And those of us who look for the truth without having any ideological, you know, pressure, there's nothing that biases. We were right on every single issue in public health. They were wrong on every single issue. So why do they have all the power and they're the only ones to listen to? That's how much propaganda and conditioning can do to the human mind and the ability to look for the truth. Let's go to him now. Again, this is a lecture he's giving. It's in two parts. Part one is today. And just see whether you agree or disagree with him. I disagree with him on global warming because it is the responsibility to look at what's happening that has never happened before. Hottest days in the world, hottest cities in the world, agriculture being destroyed, people dying, then massive flooding. It's all from the same phenomena. You can have the coldest day because of the vortex, the Arctic vortex, and you can also then have the hottest day, both from climate disruption, including even natural cycles. and this cycle we're in now is not good. And it's, if you take all the aggregate parts and put them together, it's a big problem. And if you doubt me, then ask the people who now have had flooding in Vermont and communities that had never flooded, New York State the same, wiping out homes and businesses, flooding whole streets, and then heat so bad that it's burning up the crops in our corn belt, our wheat belt. Yeah, then that's going to cause those places to be vulnerable for future food production. There are consequences. Here's the difference. I believe that we should eliminate all of these polluting factors, but over a period of time, and in that period, you re-educate, you retool for non-polluting industries so people who have work in these industries can transfer, if they choose, into industries where they still have a living wage, and but they're producing something that's non-polluting. It's how we go about this that's being overlooked and politicized and weaponized. Now to his talk.
It has been said that the most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. Censorship doesn't protect the vulnerable. It rewrites history to the benefit of the powerful and to the detriment of the people. As a prolific journalist and author, Michael Schellenberger understands this keenly. Michael's work is difficult to describe simply because it's so wide-ranging. Yet one theme emerges. From the death of environmentalism to progressives' destruction of cities, Michael has uncovered it all, and he's done so with courage. Recently, Michael released part of the Twitter files, showing how the FBI and intelligence community discredited factual information about Hunter Biden's foreign business dealings. He also testified before the House Select Committee on the weaponization of the federal government, where he challenged the censorship industrial complex, detailing the U.S. government's support for domestic censorship and disinformation campaigns from 2016 to 2022. Insofar as we can evaluate the past few years of American history with integrity, we have Michael to thank for his dogged reporting. This evening, Michael's lecture is titled Escape the Woke Matrix, and there will be time for questions afterwards. Please join me in welcoming Michael Schellenberger to the stage.
Thank you very much. What a great pleasure to be here. You've all heard the news. Climate change is destroying your future. Carbon dioxide is accumulating in the atmosphere. The planet has warmed 1.1 degrees centigrade since the pre-industrial period. Global warming is killing the Great Barrier Reef. We also know that police killing black people is a pandemic. Murders of trans people nearly doubled over the past 4 years. But there's more to this story. Carbon emissions peaked in Great Britain over 50 years ago. Same thing in France, the United States, and indeed, over the last decade, total global emissions declined. Why haven't you read that in the New York Times or the Washington Post? Deaths from natural disasters have diminished to a few hundred a year in the United States, even as the global population quadrupled over the last century, they've declined internationally by over 90%. The cost of disasters everywhere is on decline. Why is nobody telling you that? As a result of declining deaths from extreme weather events and declining costs, what gets counted as a natural disaster has also declined. There's only one database that tracks natural disasters. It's the MDAT data center in Belgium, and total global weather and climate disasters have declined. How come nobody is saying that? The Great Barrier Reef recorded the highest amount of coral in 36 years, and maybe longer, because that's the amount of time that we've been studying and measuring the Great Barrier Reef. Why is nobody telling you that? These are my books. After I lost all of my friends and all of my financial support, not an intuitive move in your late 40s, I decided to put all my heartbreak into a single book, Apocalypse Never, which came out in 2020. I had the good fortune of it selling, and so I got to write a follow-up book, which was to understand, why do people who say they care more than anybody else let people suffering from schizophrenia smoke fentanyl and have the bottom parts of their legs rot on the street, where they are then taken into the hospital and have the bottom parts of their legs amputated? Why do they then put them back on the street? Why do we spend 10 times more than other cities on homelessness and have those outcomes? How is that compassionate? And why is it done in the name of care? There are no racial differences in police killings when accounting for whether or not the suspect was armed or a threat, justified or unjustified. Everybody knows this. There's no real debate about the data. The person who's done the most to discover this is Roland Fryer at Harvard University. You might have heard of Harvard University. And yet nobody talks about this. Police killings of African Americans declined from 217 per year in the 1970s to 157 per year in the 2010s in 58 of the largest US cities. That's based on FBI data that my colleagues and I personally crunched. This is wonderful news. Police killings of all races declined dramatically from 59 per year between 1970 and 1975 to 12 per year. Now, the rate of police killings in San Francisco and Oakland did increase slightly from 2.7 and 2.8 per year, respectively, in the 70s, 2.4 and 3.9. But police killings per capita in those two cities declined by 8.3%. So when you account for the increase in population, it also declined. Researchers do not know if trans people are being killed disproportionately in comparison to cisgender people, nor do they know if trans homicides are rising, nor if trans people are being killed for being trans or for some other reason. There is no debate over this data. And yet CBS News irresponsibly and other news outlets suggest that they are. And that should upset you, especially if you care very much about trans people, because what you would not want to do is have a bad baseline for monitoring such terrible forms of violence. Why in the world does everybody get it so horribly wrong, unethically wrong, not just analytically wrong? Some of these things are easier to explain than others. There have been major disinformation campaigns waged by senior leaders in our government. They got an entire FBI investigation based on a made-up memo that suggested that Putin controlled Trump because prostitutes urinated on him in a bed. That is what happened. My mother still believes that Trump is a Russian asset because of that disinformation campaign. The labs leak all the time and have leaked for 50 years all around the world. The idea that COVID might have leaked from a lab was obvious to everybody, including the scientists who emailed Anthony Fauci on January 30th, 2020. In their email to him, they said, "We think it's more likely to be a lab leak." Several days later, Fauci perpetuated a disinformation campaign that suggested that you were a racist for suggesting that the COVID-19 virus came from a lab, but not a racist if you thought it came from Chinese people eating bats. That happened. People said it was misinformation to suggest that vaccines had side effects. People said that the Hunter Biden laptop was disinformation, not that it fell into a bathtub because Hunter Biden was hammered and smoking crack. Instead, somehow, the Russians had gotten Hunter Biden's laptop data and then got it onto a laptop and then dropped it off at a computer repair store. It was the most cockamamie story, a conspiracy theory, and it was perpetuated by senior members of the US government, retired and employed. And people say that the Twitter files just showed people doing content moderation, not censorship. These are senior elected officials who carried out this disinformation campaign. We now know absolute certainty that the FBI should never have launched that probe. Here's the email from the senior scientist to Fauci. Some of the features potentially look engineered. The furin cleavage site that does not belong on the spike protein was obviously engineered, and people knew that right away. And yet the Washington Post suggested that Tom Cotton keeps repeating a coronavirus fringe theory that scientists have disputed. The original headline, which Washington Post changed without acknowledging it on their article, said that he was spreading a debunked conspiracy theory. The Washington Post, which broke the famous Watergate scandal, spreads disinformation. Fauci and his colleagues constructed a fake science article in one of the formerly greatest medical journals in the world, suggesting conspiracy theories were what those lab leak hypotheses were. The Great Barrington Declaration, co-authored by a new friend, Jay Bhattacharya of Stanford University, that Jay Bhattacharya is a fringe epidemiologist, a full professor at Stanford University, and one of the most beautiful individual people you'll ever meet. And Francis Collins, the head of the National Institutes of Health, the greatest medical organization and organizations in the world, formerly greatest, said that there needs to be a quick and devastating published takedown of his premises. The Great Barrington Declaration argued that the approach to the pandemic should be the approach to the pandemic that everybody agreed the approach to a pandemic should be before there was a pandemic, which is known as focused protection of the most vulnerable, but allowing children to go to school so they could actually learn something. I don't want to make it personal, but you do need to name names when you are uncovering bad behavior. And this person, Renee Diresta, is the smartest of the people in every room she's in, and she's a former CIA fellow, ostensibly former. One of the things that you learn when you interview people in the intelligence community is they say, nobody retires from the intelligence community. Nobody retires from the... This is a person who ran a censorship operation with US taxpayer dollars that involved the Department of Defense, the National Science Foundation, the Department of Homeland Security. It subcontracted out the censorship work to four organizations that constituted the creme de la creme, people that went to places like Harvard and Stanford and apparently had their consciences ripped out from their hearts and their brains, and got themselves in a situation of censoring the rabble, or what Hillary Clinton calls the deplorables, for doing things like questioning the elections or sharing stories of vaccine side effects on Twitter and Facebook. This was such a smashing success that they're now exporting to other countries, and there's nothing that's been done to stop this. Our work has not stopped this. This is continuing. Here's what Twitter did to Jay Bhattacharya. They put him on a blacklist. The word blacklist is not my word. That's the Twitter internal word. You can see it right there in yellow on his profile. Trends blacklist. You can imagine the shock that overcame Barry Weiss and Matt Taibbi and I when we saw this. He's one of the most important epidemiologists in the world, and he was on a blacklist because he suggested doing with the pandemic what everybody agreed we should do during a pandemic before there was a pandemic. The behavior from the White House is remarkable. Thuggish would describe it, bullying. Rob Flaherty in particular, who sent this email to Facebook and got this response back from Facebook, whose names we shielded, not the public officials. Their names should be known. And the Facebook executive said, yes, sir, please know that we are censoring even true stories of vaccine side effects. So mothers sharing stories of their children getting sick from the vaccine had their posts censored without their knowledge so that other mothers would not see them. This happened, and there's no debate about that this happened. There's a lawsuit about this, and only a question is only whether it violated the First Amendment. It's still, in my humble view, as a non-First Amendment scholar, a violation of the First Amendment to have the government have other people demand the censorship or to demand that Facebook engage in the censorship. Matt Taibbi discovered that in this email from the Virality Project, which was a project funded by US government contractors, that they demanded that Twitter censor, and you can see it in the yellow highlight in the middle, true content which might promote vaccine hesitancy. It's not that the information was wrong, because of course the First Amendment also protects wrong information, but they wanted to censor accurate information because they were worried that people might get the wrong idea and choose not to get the vaccine. I got the vaccine, I got boosted. Nothing, I love, vaccines are a miracle, but this is totalitarian tactics to censor this kinds of information. FBI came to us, said Mark Zuckerberg, as he has rapidly sought to shift the blame away from taking responsibility. The FBI came to us and were like, hey, you should be on the high alert. We thought there was a lot of Russian propaganda in the 2016 election. There's about to be some kind of dump similar to that. He's referring to the FBI coming to them to say that they should be ready to censor the Hunter Biden laptop. That's weird, because there had been no publicity of the Hunter Biden laptop yet. Perhaps it's just a coincidence that the FBI had been sitting on the Hunter Biden laptop for almost a year. And this wasn't the beginning. Twitter was under intense pressure. We have seen a sustained effort by the intelligence community to push us to share more info and change our API policies. They're probing and pushing everywhere they can, including by whispering to congressional staff, complained the Twitter director of policy on January 2020. The story exploded on October 14th. Twitter's internal safety, trust and safety department, which is the censorship department at Twitter, evaluated the New York Post article, and they concluded that it did not violate Twitter's terms of service, that the article was entirely, there was no evidence that it was inaccurate or that it was a result of hacking. They censored it anyway. Here's the subpoena from the FBI confiscating the laptop in December 2019, almost a year before the New York Post story. Here's the signature by Hunter Biden on the receipt dropping the laptop off at the computer repair store after he had dropped it in the bathtub or the pool. Weirdly enough, in the Twitter files, we discovered that there had been preparation for how to not cover the Hunter Biden laptop months before the New York Post published an article about the Hunter Biden laptop. What's the Aspen Institute doing, gathering journalists to talk about how not to cover a story that hadn't even broke yet? What is going on here? Why is it that they were programming journalists to disregard one of the most important journalistic principles that's been in place for over 50 years? It's known as the Pentagon Papers principle, and it's if it's a whistleblower comes to you and they have documents showing that the Pentagon knows that they're losing the war in Vietnam, that the New York Times and the Washington Post shall publish those documents because that's important to the public interest, and goddammit, it's protected by the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. That is what journalists do, and the New York Times and the Washington Post published that article, the Pentagon Papers. They won their Pulitzers for it. They defended it in court, and they won it at the Supreme Court. Steven Spielberg thought it was such an amazing story, he made a movie about it. The Aspen Institute, with Stanford, with U.S. federal government money, has been attacking this, saying, don't cover the material, cover the person who leaked it. You might remember that they disparaged Daniel Ellsberg, the Nixon folks, because he'd been going to a psychotherapist, so they tried to suggest he was a crazy person. That tactic is now being used by Democrats to disparage anybody who leaks information central to the public interest, like how's the war in Ukraine going? Interests that we share, that are public interests, that are protected by the First Amendment, that are precisely why the people that created our country demanded that there be the First Amendment to the Constitution. They didn't want the Constitution to even be in place. They didn't want a United States of America unless there was a First Amendment. That's how important it was. That's why they made it first. It's now being attacked by the people who claim to be the defenders of liberalism and democracy. It's being attacked right now. Here's the little memo they created. You can see at the top, September 2020, Aspen Digital Hack and Dump Working Group, how to brainwash journalists so they don't cover the obvious thing that's sitting in front of their face. It's all done in the name of protecting people, fragile people, and you need to be protected from information, which is so dangerous. Here's Twitter's top censor, Yul Roth. He said, you know, we got to get to Jack Dorsey, the CEO. We got to convince him. We got to start by censoring, without anybody knowing it, information that directly causes harm. Now they're trying to read your text messages. Pierre Omidyar, who made his money on eBay, spinning off a Defense Department technology, they're now trying to read your encrypted text messages, and they're trying to create something called tip lines to turn everybody into little narcs. Why? You don't need the Stasi, you just have each other to go and report on your wrong think to the FBI or the CIA or whatever have it. Jacinda Ardern, the Prime Minister of New Zealand, who was so unpopular because her COVID policies were so wrong, hurt so many people, she's been picked up by Harvard to head up their censorship initiative. She's working with Facebook and Google to do it globally. It's much easier now to censor because there's only two important platforms, maybe just one, Facebook and Twitter. I mean, imagine having to censor hundreds of newspapers. You don't have to do that anymore. You can just censor Twitter and Facebook. It's much worse than you think, a whistleblower told me who works for all the social media companies. There's a complex where cancellations and pressure campaigns are well organized by outside groups. It's a total conflict waged in every school, business, and platform. Is it a conspiracy? Is it a culture? Yes. Conspiracy means to breathe together. It's cancel culture with an inorganic overlay that we call the censorship industrial complex. This is here. It has arrived. It's in place. Our job now is simply to dismantle and defund it. So how did this happen? What was going on here? Propaganda, according to Jacques Ellul in his great book, draws on existing values. We want to move beyond racial discrimination. We want to move beyond discrimination against sexual minorities. And so they tap into that. So your propaganda is about controlling the information environment. The concern of the advocates of disinformation isn't to wipe out every instance of a piece of information. Hunter Biden laptop story got out there, but people like myself and my mother and everybody in my liberal family all thought it was Russian disinformation. So the censorship was in service of the disinformation. It's not that the censors, they know they can't be total. They don't need to be total. They just need to brainwash you into thinking that something is wrong when it's right. What is going on in 2010? Something happened. Zach Goldberg, Manhattan Institute, finds that the terms racist and racism just exploded into the news media in this period. And little surprise then that the ideology follows. How big of a problem is racism? It's a much bigger problem than people had thought. People thought it was a declining problem for years. We thought that relationships between white and black Americans had been pretty good, 70% since the last 20 years, and they just plummet after you're told repeatedly through propaganda that things have gotten worse somehow. Some of this is just the elites in an absolute panic after the revolutions of 2016, Brexit and Trump. They had to get control of the information environment. They had to be able to wage war when they wanted to wage war. They had all these overproduction of elites sitting around after they had successfully prosecuted the war on terror. They needed something to do. They turned inward. And they tapped into cancel culture, what we call wokeism, as predicates for censorship. Why, though? Why? Why? Why can't we just live in peace and have debates and free speech? Why? Part of it, I think, has to do with the fact that nobody believes we don't have the traditional value systems that we used to have. This is a very old trend. This is what Friedrich Nietzsche wrote about in the mid-19th century, the death of God. We don't have traditional moral structures. The percentage of Americans with no religious identity has risen dramatically. Ernest Becker, in his brilliant Pulitzer Prize-winning 1975 book, said, "Man cannot endure his smallness unless he can translate it into meaningfulness at the largest possible level." The idea that we just die and turn into worm food is pretty depressing, particularly if you think that your life isn't very exciting or interesting. So we overcompensate by constructing monuments to our lives. We can rest assured knowing that our names will live on. These are called immortality projects, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with them, particularly if you sublimate and create beautiful immortality projects. The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else. It's like a mainspring of human activity, designed largely to avoid the fatality of death, to overcome it by denying in some way that it is the final destiny of man. We deny it, we sublimate it, we create monuments, we write books, we lead political campaigns, but things can go terribly awry when we're outside of a positive moral framework. The problem of disbelieving in God is not that man ends up believing in nothing. It's much worse. He ends up believing anything. Climate change, a new external authority. You used to get right by God, now you get right by nature. You used to feel guilty for Adam and Eve eating from the tree of knowledge. Now you feel guilty that we started using fossil fuels and technology and nuclear power and modern agriculture. We're guilty, 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 guilty. Nature's angry at you. It wants to punish you. There's no redemption, but you might avert narrowly apocalypse by harmonizing with nature through renewables and organics. Power has got to move from your local authorities, got to move from the people you vote for to the people that you don't vote for, to the experts in places like Brussels and the United Nations and International Energy, to people who know how to get you right by nature. We have a new priest class, and we have a new set of witches. Race is the new moral order. We know it used to be people of color, but that wasn't precise enough. Now we know it's BIPOC, so it's black indigenous people to rule over Latinos and Asians on the moral hierarchy. It's got to be clear. You've got to feel guilty. There's no redemption, really, but you can get right by the new moral order by knowing your place. Get in your place. Know your race. Get in your place. It's not about equal justice under the law anymore. That's an old idea. Now it's we're gonna have the laws enforced differently. Canada is pioneering this. California is pioneering this. We should be ruled by the victims. We can figure out who was victimized the most. They should have the most power. There's a new set of witches. A new view of human nature. You do have a soul. It's called your gender. You're the God. You can change your body however you like. Forget what they say about chromosomes and whatnot. You can reshape your body. You are who you say you are. Drugs and surgery are gender-affirming. Preventing drugs and surgery is conversion therapy, and we have a new set of witches. Social media plays a role. Look at that. Jonathan Haidt is absolutely right. Anybody that's been reading Jonathan Haidt knows that he's won this argument. You got it, John. Stop. You've convinced everybody. You've made us all anxious. We feel like, oh my God, everybody's watching me. Everyone can see me. It's Foucault's panopticon. It's on your phone. Everybody can see. They can see I might be a bad person. I better get on the side of the bullies to protect myself. I better participate in the attacks on the witches, or I might be victimized. Anxiety, anxiety. We see the rise of cluster B personality disorders, which are described as four different manifestations. Some people think there's just a single, doesn't matter. DSM, antisocial, borderline, histrionic, narcissistic. I'm not diagnosing anybody. That's not what I'm about to do. But you see the behaviors, and they're recognizable to you. The greatest scholar of narcissism, Sam Vaknin, says, I'm a narcissist, so take my word for it. Listen to me. And Sam is brilliant. Certain people are prone to adopt victimhood as an identity. Victimhood endows their life with meaning. You know this type of person. They would be victims even in situations where they've not been victimized. They want to be victimized. Look at me, I'm a victim. I have higher moral status than you because of it. So entitlement, grandiosity, I'm entitled to tell you what to do because I'm more of a victim than you. Splitting, you're either with me or you're against me. I need the attention, give it to me. Impaired reality, lack of empathy for oppressors, excessive empathy for victims. It's very dangerous if you're a perennial victim. This is your identity. You would tend to develop attendant behaviors. If you don't get special treatment, you'll become aggressive. You know what these folks are like. You feel like you're walking on eggshells around them. You're anxious around them. Splitting. Everyone says there is no black and white issue, said Greta Thunberg, but I think this is. Either we go on as civilization or we don't. We must stop using fossil fuels right now, or you're a bad person. The infiltration of narcissists and psychopaths is universal in all these victimhood movements. They become the public face of the movement. If you're going to go and celebrate your status by not wearing a mask and wearing a beautiful ball gown, and everyone else is wearing masks, then you better explain that, and you better explain why you're demanding that children wear masks in schools. What would lead otherwise decent people? I have no doubt that the people with their fists upheld are, I no doubt that they are empathic people, caring people, they care more. What would lead them to do this? To raise their fists above this young woman who later said in a Washington Post op-ed that she attended Black Lives Matter protests. She supports police reform. She just didn't think that she should have to raise her fists against a mob, that's not what she understood the First Amendment in America to be about. If an individual in a position of political power is a psychopath, he or she can create an epidemic of psychopathology in people who are not essentially psychopathic. They're not psychopaths. They're behaving like psychopaths. Create a culture of cluster B personality disorders. These are not the signs that people want to censor. They want to censor other people's signs, the signs that say, respect trans people, or your pronouns will be was, were. That's a death threat. That poster just went up in Britain today. The potential for aggression and victimhood movements is much larger than in the general population. Anything that is grievance-based leads to violence and death. These boots stomp turfs. If you start talking about a genocide against you and your folks, and there's no genocide, be very careful around these folks. That's dangerous. Because if you think a genocide is being perpetuated against your people, then almost anything is justified. This is antisocial personalities, personality behaviors. These kinds of things. Assaulting somebody for what they said. It's narcissism. Pay attention to me. I threw soup on a Van Gogh painting. In the 1950s, these courageous students had milkshakes poured on their heads in order to be able to sit peacefully at a lunch counter in the South. Now they throw soup on the painting and they want to be famous. That's different motivations. That's not the same thing. Histrionic. My future's coming to an end. It's desperate. It must happen now. It's tempting to wonder, is it all coming to an end? Is this it? It's pretty dark. I never said it was going to be an uplifting speech. Civilizations, on average, 336 years. That's the most comprehensive study. We're at 250. It's been a good run. Not so fast, right? Come on. It's the United States of America. This place is amazing. Amazing. We have the First Amendment. We have the First Amendment. And we're going to fight for it, right? We're a country of renewal. We're a country we want change. You can remake yourself. Somehow I became a free speech advocate. I was like a nuclear power advocate like 5 minutes ago. The Netherlands was one of the first modern civilizations, rich. It's still great. God, have you been to Amsterdam? Incredible. They had an open drug scene, homeless crisis like we have, and they got people the care they needed. They got them into treatment. They intervened, got them on methadone, got them into recovery. Amsterdam is amazing. It's an old civilization. and they're doing great. You need at least these four things: equal justice under the law, meritocracy, cheap energy, freedom of speech. If you don't have them, you might be able to get away with the first three, but then it's not a liberal democracy if it's just the first three. So what do we do about it? You can't just condemn. My friends on the right, they love to condemn. Ugh, condemn, condemn, condemn. This is bad, bad, bad. It's not good enough. You have to explain it. That's what I've been trying to do. This is the most important book I read on this issue in the last couple of years. Politics is no, Andrew, I'm going to butcher it, Lobachevsky, lived under the Nazis, lived under communism in Poland, psychologist, and he said, it's not just that totalitarianism, it's not just that the institutions are immoral and wrong, it's all, yes, that's true, but the people in them, they're psychopaths and narcissists. There's something wrong with the people that got in charge. It's a pathocracy, he said. It's a sick bureaucracy. You got to get those people out. You can't have psychopaths and narcissists running your government. Naturally, we should take care when confronting monsters, lest we not become them ourselves. For me, having come back to my faith, this is the most important challenge. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. I can't do this, but it makes me better to try. And I came back to it when trying to figure out how do you deal with personalities like the Cluster B personalities. It's not going to work if we hate them. It's going to take some courage. Some people are starting to show it. So thrilled Glenn Lowry's here. Glenn, such a fan.
Again, you can agree or disagree with what he has to say. But what we should understand is if someone shares an opinion backed up by what they consider objective facts, I think we have a responsibility to look into it and see if they're accurate or not. If they are, then it allows us to change our perception. And if not, then we can offer a challenge in return. So let me know what you think. Now, I'll tell you what I think. I think a lot of you could use a rest, a recovery, a time out from life. Join me and a wonderful group of people, there'll be about 30 of us, down at in Texas at the Villa. Beautiful, you just can't get a more beautiful environment. Cleaner air and the eagles flying overhead, the animals you can pet. The time to do Qigong and Tai Chi and meditation and drumming, healing and energy, healing sessions, lectures on a wide variety of topics. You can do as much or little as you want. In fact, one of the ways I program it is I think about what I used to do at the healing up at the Fertler Farm for 14 years in New York, every weekend in the summer, and then starting in 1989 through 1997, down at the Healing Springs Ranch in Texas. People love those experiences. It's not like going to a resort. It's not like going on a vacation, but it's like giving your mind, your body, your brain a vacation from all the stresses. So if you want to join us for 1 or 2 weeks in September, call Luann, 903-881-7008, 903-881-7008. That's it for today. Now, stay tuned for one of the best journalists in the world, Abby Martin.